this week, he's giving a series of 3 talks on Quantum Foundation. The first was yesterday. Today is the talk about cosmology and using the universe to measure, testing quantum mechanics in the early universe. Tomorrow at 2:30, he's giving a talk about the implications of quantum foundations for quantum gravity. Anthony has had an unusual career, an interesting career. He did his undergraduate work at Cambridge. Then he went to CISA, which was an unusual place, where he did a PhD in quantum foundations. Then he had a period of working on his own. And I also should say he was one of the last students of Dennis Sciama, who has had many, many distinguished students. Then he came to London in about 1999. Then he came to Perimeter shortly after we launched as a visitor, and was here for 4 or 5 years. And then he went to Clemson, where he's a professor of physics, and which is where he is now. Anthony is, in the estimation of many of us, the most interesting and most influential person working on the side of quantum foundations having to do with hidden variable theories, Gould de Broglie theory, and the idea that we need to modify and complete and improve quantum mechanics to understand it. And Anthony is always provocative, always stimulating, and it's a great pleasure to have him here.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be back. I have quite a lot to say. What time should I speak till?
6 or 7.
All right, 6 or 7 minutes to 2, maybe. To three. All right, so the subject is testing quantum mechanics in the early universe. There are some papers here that the bulk of this talk is based on, even though the ideas go back a lot further to the early 90s. The essential picture is that quantum mechanics is not a fundamental theory. It is a theory of a particular state of statistical equilibrium, which I will describe. There is a more general non-equilibrium theory, of which quantum mechanics is just a special case. And the more general theory is non-local and deterministic, and the probability distributions in general violate the Born rule. And the idea is that we are stuck. We're stuck in this state where we see the Born rule and we see an effective locality at the statistical level and uncertainty. We are stuck in here because of a process of relaxation that took place, presumably in the remote past. Now, if this is true, then if this relaxation process took place, as I assume, in the very early universe, then there is a possibility of testing it by studying the cosmic microwave background, because on this theory, quantum noise is actually a relic of the Big Bang, in a sense like the CMB itself. And of course, according to our current understanding, the CMB anisotropies in the temperature that we see on the sky were ultimately generated by early quantum noise in the inflationary vacuum. So if we're looking at possible deviations from the Born rule in the very early universe, it's possible that the spectrum that you would predict for the CMB could be a bit different. And in principle, one could use, if we're lucky, we could use the CMB possibly to see some signatures of what I call quantum relaxation. In other words, this early process where you relax from a non-Born rule theory to a Born rule theory. All right, so that's the aim. That's what I'm going to be talking about. But of course, we need a theory. We need a model of all this. What kind of model? I'm going to use a model that actually goes back to the early days of quantum mechanics due to Louis de Broglie, who presented it at the 5th Solvay conference, where 3 different versions of quantum mechanics were discussed, one of which is de Broglie's pilot wave theory, The history books, the textbooks usually don't tell you much about de Broglie. De Broglie did a lot more than people think. He developed a new non-Newtonian form of dynamics. I have a book co-authored about, which is basically about this conference. And my own particular interest in it was de Broglie's contributions. Anyway, you could look at this book if you want to know details. But the theory that de Broglie presented at that time for a low energy many-body system looked like this. He had the many-body Schrödinger equation, where he regarded the wave function not as a probability wave, but as an actual wave that is a property of an individual system and that guides the motion of the system according to this law of motion, which is not of the form mass times acceleration is force, it's of the form mass times velocity is equal to the gradient of the phase of this guiding wave function. So if here are the wave crests of psi, of the lines of constant phase in configuration space, this is a deterministic theory. Given a wave function, given an initial configuration, an initial position of all of these particles, this equation of motion determines the trajectory. Okay, it's a deterministic theory. And this can be, now those of you not familiar with this, you might think of this as being a bit like what you do when you have a WKB wave function and you associate classical trajectories with it using precisely this equation. It's just like that, except this is not just for WKB wave functions, it's for any wave function. Similarly, of course, de Broglie presented it for many body low energy system, but you can generalize it to any system with a wave function in configuration space. It could be a wave functional for a field theory. We'll look at that later. Now there's the question, well, this is a determinist, in principle, it's a deterministic theory of single systems. If you look at an ensemble of systems with the same wave function, but where over the ensemble, the distribution of initial positions has some distribution. It could be, some arbitrary initial distribution of positions, let's call it P, you find that you get agreement with quantum mechanics if the initial distribution happens to be equal to psi squared. Now remember, psi here is in principle not a probability wave, it's a wave guiding the system with an amplitude squared. If P happens to equal psi squared, then that distribution is preserved in time by the dynamics and you obtain the same statistical predictions as quantum theory, as was shown in detail by Bohm in 1952. Just to show you that, of course, this is not for just a low energy system. Again, as I mentioned, any system with a configuration, wave functional, if I have a Schrödinger equation with a conserved current, in fact, I've shown in a paper with Ward-Struve that if you have a Hamiltonian, any Hamiltonian given by a differential operator, you can derive a conserved current that will obey the usual continuity equation. You can define a velocity field. J and psi squared are what we call the quantum current and the quantum density. But in this theory, this is nothing to do with probabilities. It's just a property of the wave function. And the wave function generates a velocity field. This is a non-local theory. When I have entangled systems, the motion of a system over here depends instantaneously on what is done over here. So to define this theory requires an underlying preferred foliation of space-time. So it's fine in any globally hyperbolic space-time, at least. Anyway, by construction, once I have such a theory, I have a velocity field defined for the motion of each system. If I consider a distribution of these systems in configuration space, by construction, if each system moves according to this velocity field, then the distribution rho will obey this continuity equation. This continuity equation is also satisfied by psi squared. As a consequence, have I got a slide about this? No, I haven't. The same continuity equation from the Schrödinger equation, you can derive a continuity equation for psi squared. It looks exactly like this with the same velocity field. So you have a simple theorem that if rho and psi squared are initially equal, because they evolve according to the same continuity equation, they will always be equal. Okay. So let me give a simple example. classic two-slit experiment. I have a particle fired at a two-slit screen. Here's the wave function. The wave function just evolves according to the Schrödinger.
If I have a discrete system, like a bunch of spins, for example.
So then it's multi-component wave functions.
I'm just saying, what is the meaning of velocity? Because I mean, there is no continuous.
Right, okay. So what happens in the case of spin? I mean, the simplest model, the one that I prefer, you would say, for instance, a low-energy spinless particle. You have the Pauli equation for, so in other words, the Schrödinger equation for a two-component wave function. And the velocity field, so the particle doesn't actually have a spin. It just has a trajectory, okay? The spin-like properties are just a property of the wave function. And the guidance equation looks similar to this, except what you do, it's a weighted average. So you've got a two-component wave function. Each component has a phase.
Yeah.
So you have a weighted average. Basically, it's a weighted average of this law. If you have grad S for one component, grad S for the other component, the weighted average, according to the modulus squared of the components, defines a velocity field. So not when, which is just the velocity associated with the. I'm making this more complicated than it is. If you just look at the position space probability density, which is the sum of mod psi squared for the two components, the current associated with that defines a velocity field. So the actual trajectory is just a continuous, you know, it's just a particle moving around, guided by a two-component wave function. Sorry if I made that sound a bit more complicated than it is, but okay. Okay, anyway, so what was I saying?
But I think the question was slightly different if I understood it. The question is, if I have a system that doesn't have a spatial coordinate degree of freedom at all, it's just a spin that's either up or down.
Ah.
What's...
Well, okay, so this theory, at least the most common version of the de Broglie-Bohm, you assume that the system does have a configuration. Okay, it might be, you know, it might be particle positions, it might be field.
Magnets, quantum magnet, how would you describe?
So the fundamental theory here is, you know, you assume that the world is made out of, I mean, fundamentally it would be built out of fields, or if you're looking at, say, fermions, the best picture is actually with a many-body Dirac equation, so you've got particles. So you've got particles for fermions and fields for bosons being guided by a wave function. And the spin-like properties come from the multi-component, the many components in the wave function. If you just had a system, you see, one point about this is that when you discuss the theory of measurement in de Broglie-Bohm, the way you get an effective collapse of the wave function is that the wave function separates into non-overlapping packets in configuration space. So that the system, you know, the actual trajectory is either in this packet or in that packet. And if it's in just one packet, then in effect, its subsequent motion is guided just by this packet. And it's important in this theory, in order to derive equivalence to quantum mechanics, that you have a separation in configuration space. So, you know, if you had a system where you're just interested in the spin, I mean, I think you would have to, in this theory, you would have to say, well, look, hang on, what's the system actually made of? There is a configuration, there are particle positions, or there are fields, and we need to consider them in order to discuss the theory properly. So
what was I saying? So
the Born distribution is preserved in time by the dynamics. So as a simple example, I have my two slit, the Schrödinger wave coming in. The particle starts at some point. Its mass times velocity is equal to the gradient of phase. Here it will just move in a straight line. Here it will wiggle around. It will land somewhere. If it started somewhere else, it would go through here, would land somewhere else. Now, simple theorem. If I repeat this experiment over an ensemble and the distribution of initial positions was equal to psi squared, by construction, the distribution of positions later on will be psi squared, and so you'll get the standard interference pattern. On the other hand, if the initial distribution is not psi squared, you can get something different. So, extreme example, if all of the initial positions started close to this point, all of the final positions would land around here, and you wouldn't see this pattern. You would just see a little blob here, okay? So it's a simple example showing you that, well, in this theory, quantum theory is a special case of a wider physics. So that raises the question, well, why experimentally do we always see the Born rule? So for example, if I prepare a particle in a two-dimensional box in a state that we normally call a superposition of the first 16 energy states, psi squared looks like this. And if I prepared an ensemble of such systems and measured their positions, I would obtain this distribution. Why? So this theory, and of course, usually we just take the Born rule to be a law of physics. In my view, at least, in this theory, the fundamental laws, these are the fundamental laws. The Born rule is just a distribution of initial conditions. It's you know, there's a difference between laws of motion and initial conditions. There's no reason why you have to begin with this distribution. So why do we always see this distribution? This theory gives quite a good answer, which is that, well, if you begin, so here is the psi squared for 16 modes. And of course, if you allow it to evolve in time, just according to the Schrödinger equation, this is the Schrödinger evolution of psi squared for that 16-mode system. If I begin with a probability density that is different from psi squared, so for example, like this, and you do a numerical simulation and you calculate the motion of the trajectories. I have an ensemble of trajectories here. So here's an example of what a trajectory looks like. So if you have the law of motion, mass times velocity is gradient of phase, where the phase is the phase of this wave function that's a superposition of 16 modes, this is the kind of trajectories that you get. They're pretty rapid and erratic. And if you start off with a distribution of positions like this and you evolve forward in time, this is what happens. We've done some coarse graining here, but you see how the relaxation to equilibrium just over one period. So this is, by the way, one period. This is a periodic, psi squared is periodic. And you see the relaxation to equilibrium, a little bit crudely speaking, analogous to relaxation to thermal equilibrium. Okay, in classical statistical physics, I have a box of gas, the molecules all start in the corner, you let it go, they run around, they bounce around, they relax to equilibrium. This relaxation can be, you can develop something that's a bit analogous to classical statistical mechanics, but it's in configuration space instead of phase space. You can quantify the relaxation with a coarse-grained H function, which is just minus the relative entropy of the density and psi squared. This obeys a coarse-graining H theorem, assuming no fine-grained structure initially in rho and psi squared. This is a time reversal invariant dynamics. As in classical physics, you can only show relaxation if you make some assumption about the initial condition. So here we're assuming there's a no fine-grained structure in rho and psi squared, but of course, as the system evolves, so here there's a smooth distribution. This plot here, we've used some small coarse graining cells. If you look at the fine grain density in a small region, it develops very fine grain structure, as you can imagine, because these trajectories are so erratic. Anyway, this quantifying the coarse grained H function, well, all of our simulations have shown an approximate exponential decay. So this is logarithm of the coarse-grained H function versus T. So you get an approximate exponential decay. Another simulation, this was a two-dimensional oscillator with 25 modes in superposition. Here now time is going downwards. Here is psi squared. This is the quantum equilibrium distribution evolving in time. Okay, I have a superposition of 25 oscillator modes evolving. We started with initial rho that's a Gaussian. And you can see how it evolves towards equilibrium. Yes, sorry.
Is it possible to use infinite number of entangled particle waves to produce the patterns of interference?
Sorry, are you saying that if I had a system that consists of entangled particles?
Entangled pilot waves.
Yes. If you have particles that are entangled, then it's just a higher dimensional system. The pilot wave is in a higher dimensional. For instance, this could be, I could imagine if I have two particles moving in one dimension, okay, as a simple model, and they're entangled. And let's say I have two one-dimensional oscillators that are entangled. So the actual configuration space is two-dimensional, so this could be exactly such a system. Instead of being one two-dimensional oscillator, this could be two 1D oscillators that are entangled, if you like. So anyway, and again, here I'm plotting H against T rather than log H, and you see again, approximate exponential decay. Relaxation tends to be faster for larger numbers of modes, as you might imagine. Very crudely, the time scale is of order the time scale of the wave function evolution, very, very crudely. Okay, now this is all background, by the way, so I have a lot to say. What is the message I'm trying to get across? That according to this theory, at least the way I view it, the Born probability rule is not a law of nature. It holds only because we are stuck in equilibrium. And we're stuck in equilibrium because everything we can see has a long and violent history. Okay, if I do an experiment, if I take a hydrogen atom in the lab and I start doing an experiment with it, this atom has not been sitting in a vacuum for billions of years. It's been interacting with it. It has a history that traces back to the Big Bang. Everything that we can touch and see has a long and violent astrophysical history. So there's been plenty of time for this relaxation to occur. In fact, one would have expected it to have occurred in the very early universe. So when did quantum relaxation happen? Presumably a long time ago, soon after the Big Bang. That's the hypothesis. And of course, it's a hypothesis. Maybe the universe just started in equilibrium, or maybe the Breuboehm theory is all completely wrong, and so on. But anyway, here are some ideas which, if they are true, then we can test it. If quantum noise is a relic of the Big Bang, possibly there are signatures of quantum relaxation imprinted on the cosmic microwave background. And that's what I want to talk about. So this is all just a sort of preliminary, yes?
I compared to thermal equilibrium, then if two systems of different equilibrium coming local contact, then there's a deviation from the equilibrium for a short time. Do you?
Right. So, okay. Interesting. Interesting.
System can go out of the
right. So interesting question. So as I said, there are analogies with classical statistical mechanics, but also differences. So in the classical theory, you can have thermal equilibrium at different temperatures. As far as I've been able to understand, there isn't really an analog of that. Here, the equilibrium state is just probabilities equal to psi squared. And, you know, for instance, if I have two different systems with two different wave functions, if they're both in equilibrium, P is psi squared and P is psi prime squared, you know, you're in equilibrium and you're stuck there.
So, why do we need to go to the CMB? I mean, in the lab, we have lots of control on quantum systems. We can prepare
good
anything you want.
Sure.
Regardless of what interaction might have had.
Right. So the problem with that is that, as I mentioned, you go in the lab and all the systems that you have, you would have expected them to have reached equilibrium a long time ago.
Take them out of equilibrium.
Okay. So the problem here is that, at least as far as anyone has been able to understand, once systems are in equilibrium, there's no way to get out of equilibrium, barring some new exotic effects, which actually I'm going to talk about tomorrow. I have some speculations that maybe quantum gravitational effects could knock systems out of equilibrium. But the theory here, this kind of theory, with a conserved current like this, once you're in this state, the dynamics just keeps you in this state. You know, you might think, well, I could just extract a sub-ensemble, but you know, if you have an ensemble of systems that is in equilibrium, you know, I extract a particle at random from it, well, the probability of its position probability is going to be psi squared for, you know, the probability distribution of the parent system. When I first started looking at this theory, I tried all kinds of ways, tricks. Is there a way of it? It seems not. It seems that here, once you're in equilibrium, you're stuck there. Unless we're missing something. So as I said, barring some exotic new effects, possibly involving quantum gravity or black holes, which I'll talk about tomorrow, it seems that, well, you know, once you're in equilibrium, you're stuck there. And so the idea is to go back to the beginning and see if there are any signatures of quantum relaxation in the CMB. So I was told that I should aim this at a master's student audience. Maybe I should give a quick 2-minute cosmology crash course We're going to be looking at flat expanding space. Coordinate distances correspond to a physical distance that is scaled up, the scale factor that's determined by the Einstein equations. For instance, in a radiation-dominated universe, it goes as t to the half. Physical wavelengths grow with time because space is expanding. Let's see. The Hubble radius, important quantity. It measures the rate of spatial expansion. It's a characteristic length scale of the expanding universe. And an important thing about it that will come up a lot is that if you're in the short wavelength limit, you're looking at, say, a field, we're going to be looking at a field theoretical system, the short wavelength modes evolve as if they're on Minkowski spacetime. In the long wavelength limit, there's an interesting property that people who work in classical cosmological perturbation theory will know all about, that the perturbations tend to freeze on super Hubble wavelengths. They tend not to evolve. Okay. Quick 30-second picture of our understanding of the temperature anisotropy in the CMB is that, you know, there is this question, well, the CMB was formed around 400,000 years after the Big Bang. It's slightly anisotropic. The temperature varies fractionally of order about 10 to the minus 4 over the sky. Why? Why is it not perfectly uniform? Because the universe 400,000 years after the Big Bang was not completely homogeneous. Why was it not completely homogeneous? Our current understanding is that, well, way back during inflation, there were quantum fluctuations in the inflationary or Bunch-Davies vacuum, approximately. And these quantum fluctuations form the seeds for small classical perturbations in the curvature, and these, so you know, very early times you've got a small slight inhomogeneities that can then grow with time under, you know, gravitationally, and by the time you get to the formation of the CMB, you've got these small inhomogeneities that are there that are then imprinted on the CMB. All right, so now we want to be looking at correction. If the Born rule was violated in the early universe, we want to see how that could affect the CMB. So let's just a quick two-minute crash course in inflationary theory of the CMB spectrum. So there is an inflaton, a scalar field during the inflationary period, which its quantum fluctuations generate classical curvature perturbations. The curvature perturbations generate coefficients that correspond to a temperature anisotropy. It's actually maybe easier to think of this backwards. So we look at the sky and we see a temperature on the sky that varies slightly with angle. Okay, let's call this delta T. This is the sort of difference between the temperature and the average. This is the average temperature, averaged over the sky. It's a function of angle on the sky. You can expand it in terms of spherical harmonics. So the temperature function on the sky is equivalent to this set of coefficients. There is a formula for this set of coefficients that's given in terms of the curvature perturbation at early times, where T is the transfer function encodes the astrophysics of how curvature perturbations generate temperature anisotropies. These are known functions. And going further back, well, where did the curvature perturbation come from? It came from an inflaton perturbation that maybe never mind about this. Basically, the curvature perturbation is proportional to the inflaton perturbation evaluated at a time when the wavelength has exited the Hubble radius. Okay, this is sort of standard formalism that you can by now find in any textbook. But now, here is an interesting question. Now what we do, we're talking about a single sky, how the temperature pattern anisotropy forms on a single sky. We're now going to consider a theoretical ensemble. And I'll say a bit more about what that means in a moment. Let's consider a theoretical ensemble. Let's take this coefficient, let's take the modulus squared and average over a theoretical ensemble. If we assume that the theoretical ensemble is statistically isotropic, you can show that the average of this mod ALM squared is actually independent of M. Okay, and this is called the angular power spectrum. and is given by this formula where this PR is basically just the variance of the curvature perturbation. So this angular power spectrum depends on, well, I said it depends on the primordial probability distribution. More precisely, it depends on the variance of the primordial probability distribution for the curvature perturbation. And the variance of this is proportional to the variance of the inflaton perturbation, which you can calculate from quantum field theory in the Bunch-Davies vacuum, is given by this formula where H is the Hubble parameter during inflation. All right, now this CL is measured. Here you plot LL plus 1 times CL. This is a sort of standard thing, plotting against multipole moment. This is the sort of thing that you measure. Now, if this was an audience of cosmologists, I would just carry on from here, but there are some foundations people here, and there's always somebody who asks, how can you talk about probabilities when you only have one universe? So let me talk about how, at least my understanding of how cosmologists think about this, is that you assume that it's up to you how you think about your theoretical ensemble. Some people will think that, you know, there's some, maybe we're just in some little patch and there really is an ensemble of patches. So it's an actual ensemble. Others will think in terms of some Bayesian knowledge. However you want to think about your theoretical ensemble, an assumption is made that the probability of seeing a certain temperature pattern on the sky is the same if we rotate that temperature pattern slightly, or even by a large amount, the probability is the same. In other words, the ensemble of skies, if you like, is statistically isotropic. Now, if you make that assumption, you can show that the average of these, the product of these quantities, takes this diagonal form where this coefficient here does not depend on M. In other words, statistical isotropy implies that the theoretical ensemble average of ALM squared is independent of M. Now, what happens on one sky? Of course, you're looking at, you measure the temperature and isotropy, you get a whole bunch of these coefficients. For each value of L, for each value of L, there are two L plus one values of M. So what happens? Let's measure the ALM for R1 sky, take the modulus square. This is something that you measure for one sky, and let's just take the average. Now, this statistic that you measure for one sky, if you ask what is its ensemble average is just CL, which is the theoretical quantity that we're talking about. In other words, this quantity is an unbiased estimate of this. So this quantity CL that we calculate is a theoretical quantity for the ensemble. This thing that we measure is an unbiased estimate of that. So if L is not too small, so we've got two L plus one values here, then you will probably find that this thing that you measure is close to the theoretical CL. And of course there is a, if L is small, then you get what's called the cosmic variance, and there's actually some uncertainty there. Okay, so we can probe probability with these assumptions of statistical isotropy. There's actually also an assumption of statistical homogeneity that is used when you derive this formula, but I won't go into that. It looks as if, well, if I change the spectrum, if I change the variance in the early universe, so here we've got the variance of the inflaton field calculated according to quantum mechanics, if I do a de Broglie-Bohm theory of the inflaton field, and I'll show you how to do that, I could have a variance that is different. It could be the quantum value multiplied by something, some correction. It turns out that something I discussed in a paper quite some years ago, which is that, well, if I just consider an inflationary period, if at the beginning of inflation I assume there is non-equilibrium of this form, in other words, a correction to the quantum variance, it just stays there. The Bunch-Davies vacuum is so simple that there's no relaxation to equilibrium. You basically have a product. It's a product state over the modes. Each wave function just contracts with time. There's no you know, complicated evil. The trajectories are very simple. There's no relaxation. So basically, you get out what you put in at the beginning. If there's non-equilibrium at the beginning of inflation, it will stay there. And, you know, you can try to set some empirical limits on this factor. This is minus H. This is the relative entropy of the probability with respect to psi squared. I put a sort of very rough upper bound on it. Nothing particularly interesting or helpful. Basically, the quantum theory agrees approximately with what we see. So if there are going to be deviations, you know, they're not going to be, you know, over if you're in some typical point in the spectrum, you'd expect the deviations to be small, but possibly at large scales there are deviations, which I'm going to talk about. So what I want to, now I'm really getting to the focus of my talk, which is, could we make some prediction? So I think I last spoke about this here some years ago. I didn't yet have a prediction. I remember Lee coming up to me after I'd spoke about this. This may be 2006, actually. And saying, okay, the good news is if there's non-equilibrium, you'll see it. The bad news is you don't have a prediction for what the non-equilibrium will be. I remember Lee saying this. Fair enough, that was true then. Now we do have a prediction, of course, making some assumptions. Here is a strategy. Let's consider a pre-inflationary era, which...
I think the problem is a bit deeper because you may have a prediction for Kasai, which you're going to tell us, but there is no prediction for what quantum theory is going to give you because we don't know what theory of inflation you want to use.
Okay, so let us say that as a first approximation here, the model I'm going to present to you is it's a model with some simplifications. So we're during the inflationary period, we're just going to take the first approximation of the Bunch-Davies vacuum, okay?
I mean, depends on the potential you assume.
Now, sure. So the idea here is let's take the simplest model of it, the simplest inflationary model, and let's see what corrections could be generated from this stuff. And let's in particular see if there's some particular signature, some particular kind of correction. Clearly, in a realistic model, there will be other things. The inflaton potential is changing, you could have bumps, and you could have other effects. Okay, so the strategy here is to just, okay, let's take the simplest approximate model, and within this model, calculate, try to find some signature. Sure, in a realistic model, there will be other things in there as well, but hopefully, maybe we could still see our signature. That's the strategy. But fair point. A number of people, I'm certainly not the only, a number of people have considered that there is a pre-inflationary phase. The idea is that before inflation, let's start out with some non-equilibrium distribution. I'm taking a radiation-dominated era, and let's calculate quantum relaxation during that period, and let's calculate corrections to the Born rule. Let's see what they look like at the end of that period. And then let's assume that these corrections are imprinted on the inflationary spectrum. And let's then see if we can compare with data. That's the strategy. So I'm now going to present to you a model. I'm looking at a scalar field evolving on a radiation-dominated universe, which we're taking to be before inflation. Okay, so now here's my simple model. We have a flat metric. We have a free minimally coupled massless scalar field, the usual Hamiltonian density. We're going to look at it in Fourier space. Here's a Fourier component, has a real and imaginary part. We're going to take these as our degrees of freedom. The Hamiltonian becomes a sum over harmonic oscillator Hamiltonians with a time-dependent mass and angular frequency. Okay? So if I now look at the Schrödinger equation for the wave functional, so this is a function of all of these real and imaginary parts of the Fourier component. Okay, I've defined here. R is one or two. So I've got Q, R is one or two. The Schrödinger equation looks like this, and the de Broglie velocities, the analog of that, you know, mass times velocity is gradient of phase. For this system, this is the de Broglie law of motion. Okay, in de Broglie-Bohm theory, not only is there a wave functional for a scalar field. There is an actual scalar field evolving in time according to this equation of motion, okay? And if I consider a theoretical ensemble, I have some initial distribution of the field components which need not equal psi squared, and whose time evolution is determined by this continuity equation simply by construction. I'm assuming that each field in the ensemble follows this equation of motion. Now, let's consider, to simplify things, a decoupled mode. I'm going to assume that the total wave function is a product. There's one mode, there's a wave function for one mode times, you know, this is a wave function of all the rest of the modes which might be entangled, might not be entangled. Let's just take a decoupled mode and drop the index k. So I have a wave function for a system with two real degrees of freedom with some initial distribution that need not equal psi squared. So now I can show you our model. This is the model that we use to perform our numerical simulations. So we have, mathematically, this is the same as a low-energy two-dimensional harmonic oscillator with mass equal to the scale factor cubed and angular frequency equal to k over a. So we have the Schrödinger equation, the de Broglie guidance equation, and the key equation that we use to evolve the ensemble density is this here. It's the it's just the continuity equation for the density with the de Broglie velocity field. Now, something to note, all the results that I'm going to present to you come from evolving this equation, which in a sense exists in quantum mechanics. This is just the standard continuity equation that follows from the Schrödinger equation, except instead of rho being equal to psi squared, we're taking rho to be arbitrary. Okay? So the only difference is in the initial conditions. We assume that the initial time, the width of this distribution is smaller than the width of psi squared, which is, of course, impossible in quantum mechanics. So, okay, so I'm going to derive, as I've said, I'm going to show you that at long wavelengths, the variance of the mode can be, well, I'll show you. Relaxation is suppressed, and we're going to assume that a similar, that what comes out of the end of the pre-inflationary period is imprinted on the CMB. All right, so let's get on with it. We're looking still, we're in this pre-inflationary radiation-dominated background. Our model, so the first, we've done many simulations since this, but the first one we did, we took a superposition of 25, so we've got this two-dimensional oscillator with a time-dependent mass and angular frequency. The initial wave function is a superposition of 25 energy states with randomly chosen initial phases. So this is what it looks like. The initial non-equilibrium we just took to be some little Gaussian. What looks a bit like psi squared for the ground state. Well, it is actually equal to psi squared for the ground state, but the actual psi squared is very different from the ground state. What we did is we took a mode, the physical wavelength was, if I remember rightly, 10 times the Hubble radius, and we let this evolve to a time, you know, as of course you know, the wavelength of the mode starts to enter the Hubble radius. We evolved until a time such that the wavelength of the mode is equal to the Hubble radius. What did we find? All right, remember we're evolving this equation for the density. Time is going downwards. On the right-hand side, this is the quantum psi squared distribution evolving. We actually have to, because of the way things scale, this thing actually shrinks, and we need to do a rescaling to stop this thing shrinking. But anyway, apart from that's why there's a prime there, but this is the quantum equilibrium density evolving in time, okay? Just for one mode of a scalar field with a superposition of 25 energy states on expanding space. This is what it looks like. Here is our initial quantum non-equilibrium, which is a little Gaussian that's different from psi squared. This is how it evolves. And I should mention that these simulations are very numerically intensive. We have about 400,000 trajectories in here. We're lucky that in Clemson, where I'm based in the US, it's a very good engineering school and they have very good computing facilities. But anyway, this is a very non-trivial simulation. But this is what you get. You see that, it looks as if it's evolving towards equilibrium, but it doesn't quite get there, okay? It's sort of looking roughly a bit like this, but squeezed. Let's now repeat the same calculation, but with no expanding space. Okay, repeat it over the same time period, but with space not expanding, or equivalently, you could say, let's repeat the same calculation, but at very short wavelengths. You get the same thing. This is what you get. Here is psi squared evolving. Now the initial distribution, look what happens. You know, hey, presto, magic, as in the previous simulations, it evolves very closely towards quantum equilibrium. So now comparing these two, what I'm showing you is that relaxation on expanding space tends to be suppressed at very long wavelengths. At short wavelengths, or equivalently with no expanding space, you get this rapid relaxation. At long wavelengths, this was a super Hubble mode, you do get some relaxation, but you see it is suppressed. Now, as I mentioned close to the beginning, you can quantify relaxation with a coarse-grained H function. Here is log H against T. With no expanding space, you see you get this approximate exponential decay. With expanding space, it starts to relax, but then it sort of tails off. It's suppressed. Okay? So there's a suppression of relaxation at large scales on expanding space. Now, the question.
This is in the radiation era. This is the previous.
Yes, this is all I'm looking at here is a scalar field evolving on a radiation-dominated background. That's the model. There's nothing else here. It's just a simplified model of what we're going to then take to be a pre-inflationary era. Okay, the question is, could this have anything to do with the reported large-scale power deficit in the CMB? I'm quoting here Planck 2013, or Planck 2015 got similar results, a slightly less significance, but some people think, well, it's not really significant enough to worry about. Are these sort of in that borderline? I mean, if it was 3.5 sigma, then people would say, oh, maybe there's something there. Here, if it was 1.5, well, there's nothing there. Here, it's kind of, well, maybe it's just a fluctuation. Okay, maybe it's just a fluctuation, or maybe there's something there. Could it have something to do with this? That the variance here is smaller than the variance there. So, to make this more quantitative, let's write the variance for each mode as the quantum variance times this factor, which measures the power deficit. And so it's a sort of squeezed Born rule, if you like, or just looking at the variance. This, you would expect this to be smaller at longer wavelengths because there'd be less relaxation. And you'd expect it to approach 1 at short wavelengths because you're getting relaxation. So in order to get a prediction for C, we need to do this simulation many times for very different values of the wavelength and plot the results as a function of wave number. We've done this in this paper. Here is what we get. So we've done it for different numbers of modes. What I was talking about earlier was for 25 modes. We've done it for different numbers of modes. There's a fixed time interval. Let's just look at the top curve. This is, I think, for 4 modes. This is a plot of C as a function of K. You see that the power deficit is large at long wavelengths, and it gets smaller. It approaches 1, so there's no power deficit at short wavelengths. And it sort of follows a curve, it's sort of going up like this and approaching a constant, but with some oscillation. So the dot, dot, dot is a fitted curve. The actual numerical result is this oscillatory curve here. Okay. Now, the idea is that, well, there's some, this is a signature, the shape of this curve, the structure of it is telling you about, if there was quantum relaxation in the early universe, this is the sort of thing you would get. And in fact, we've run this also for different kinds of initial distributions, not just an initial Gaussian. You tend to get the same kind of pattern like this. So if something like this happened in the early universe, well, here's a sort of signature. Now, what we could do as a first stab, yes?
Were you assuming the initial variance is smaller than the quantum?
Yes. That we took that as an assumption, which, It could be bigger. To my mind, it sort of feels more natural. If you're saying that quantum noise emerges from a sort of dynamical relaxation, it feels more natural to me to begin with a state that sort of has less noise than the quantum. But absolutely right. In principle, in this theory, it could be bigger. So we've taken, as I should have mentioned somewhere, we take
Assume sub-quantum.
Yeah, we assume a sub-quantum width. Absolutely right. So good point. Okay, so now let's, as a first stab of saying, okay, what are our predictions? Let's ignore the oscillations and just look at the shape of this curve, ignoring the oscillations. There's a good fit to an inverse tangent function with three free parameters, okay? Now, we've derived, if you like, a squeeze Born rule for a spectator scalar field at the end of this radiation-dominated era. Let's assume that this same correction appears at the beginning of inflation. Now, there's a gap here in the model because we haven't done a model of the transition. So, pending a model of the transition, we've just assumed that, okay, let's take the same C function to be there imprinted at the beginning of inflation. So now the power spectrum for the curvature perturbation is given by, so well, the variance of the inferton field is corrected by this function C. So the power spectrum for the primordial curvature perturbation is corrected by the same function, where our C, ignoring the oscillations, just to make a simple start, C is predicted to have an inverse tangent form. Okay. One thing to note, we can't predict the scale, the wavelength at which this deficit sets in. And the reason is because you don't know the number of e-folds during inflation. So there's a kind of effective, this parameter C1 is going to be rescaled by the number of e-folds, and which you don't know. So we don't know where this would occur in the spectrum, but we can predict the shape. Okay, so we've got a prediction for the shape of the deviation, but not where it will be. All right, so just unfortunate, but there it is. Anyway, we have a three-parameter model of the power deficit. Actually, really, these parameters depend on the number of modes in the initial state and on the time interval of pre-inflation. It's really a two-parameter model, but it's sort of a bit complicated to work with those. We're still working on this. But anyway, let's take a three-parameter model. I've been doing for about 3 years now, working on a data analysis with Sandro Vitenti and Patrick Peter. They're both at the Cosmology Astrophysics Institute in Paris. Sandro is the main author of a package, Num Cosmo, that's used to do data analysis. He's been running the actual fits. The results are mixed, and there's no simple conclusion. Let me see if I can give, unfortunately, the paper is not quite on the archive yet, but let me just give you a general, I should mention, maybe for those who are unfamiliar with these things, what are we actually doing here? You're calculating the probability of seeing the data that we see on the sky, given the model, for varying values of these parameters, and that's the likelihood of the model given the data. We've also compared with other models. So we're predicting an inverse tangent deficit. Other people have considered a phenomenological model with an exponential cutoff. Obviously the model, a better model has a higher probability of generating the data we see. The way Sandro is doing it, he's really running this stuff. It's the likelihood ratio statistic he uses to compare models. Those who know what that is, fine. Those who don't, never mind. What are the results that we have? It's funny. So here we're fitting to cosmological data, CMB, and other data. Here's a result when we look at temperature data only. So can I take another 5 minutes, Lee? I'm going to go slightly over time, but is it 5 minutes? All right. So if you just look at the temperature data, in other words, the temperature anisotropies, the kind of results you get, well, the model, what's the evidence for the model? Well, it's around 2 sigma, just above, similar to what the Planck people got for their when they looked at the exponential cutoff. And you can't really distinguish between our inverse tangent cutoff and an exponential cutoff. They both give you, there's some improvement in the fit, and the model does pretty well, but there isn't really evidence for it. There could have been evidence against it, but there isn't, okay? But, there's some improvement in the fit. There is something, we got excited about this, is that there is a tension between the Planck, the Hubble constant as derived from the Planck data and the Hubble constant as measured locally with, you know, for, you know, astrophysically with galaxies, with galaxy recession. And what we did is we said, well, maybe the local value, the, what the astrophysicists are measuring is the correct value. We put that data point and then ran the fit. And the significance improved about 3 sigma, and we started to get excited here that basically, well, if you allow a power deficit, and then, you know, you can, or at least diminish the tension with the local value of H0, we started to get excited here. Then what we did is we added in polarization. So something I haven't mentioned, the microwave sky is also polarized, and the polarization is anisotropic, and this has been measured, and you can do a similar, you know, the power spectrum, the angular power spectrum for the polarization, which is also generated by these early fluctuations. If you add in the polarization data, our significance just disappears. You get something, you know, totally lousy, 1, 1.5 sigma or something. You add polarization data, it's gone. So now you might think, and it may be, and perhaps the conclusion here is that, well, the low power is not really there. The deficit in the temperature spectrum is just a statistical fluke. When you look at the polarization as well, well, the effect goes away. And at this point, my collaborators are sort of looking at me like a sort of dead man, you know, sorry, you know, it hasn't worked out. Maybe you've wasted your life. And maybe that's all true. But actually, there's still an alternative, actually, alternatively. So we're still, you know, this is the first data analysis we've done. There's a possibility that, well, I haven't talked about tensor modes. I've talked about the primordial curvature perturbation or scalar perturbations. There are, of course, in the early universe, transverse traceless perturbations in the metric, in other words, gravitational waves. These are called tensor perturbations. They contribute to the polarization spectrum. We've neglected, in our fits, we've been taking the ratio, the scalar to tensor ratio, to be essentially zero. I mean, it's thought to be small, less than 0.1 or something, depending on what fit you believe, but we've neglected tensor perturbations. Now, here's something. There should be some tensor perturbations in there that we're not taking into account. Something I talked about in my first paper on this was that, look, if you have scalar perturbations and tensor perturbations, these are different degrees of freedom. Now, there's no reason for the initial non-equilibrium to be the same for both. Okay, if you imagine classically, if I have 2 boxes of gas that start out of thermal equilibrium, well, there's no reason for them to have the same distribution. They could be anything. So now, according, usually during inflation, there's a close relationship between the spectrum for the scalar and the tensor perturbations. That relationship would be expected to be broken out of equilibrium, as I discussed here. So what you would expect is that, well, if I run these simulations for the scalar and tensor perturbations, you would expect that in each case I'm going to get an inverse tangent deficit, but the coefficients, you would expect them to be different for the scalar and tensor parts. So possibly, here's an idea, maybe it's probably a bit of a long shot, but still, in principle, perhaps this explains the degradation of the fit when we add the polarization data, that you know, there are 2 different non-equilibrium distributions in there, as one would expect, and maybe that's why the effect goes away when we add polarization. Maybe not. Okay, so what we have to do, and we haven't done it yet, is rerun all of these fits with scalar and tensor perturbations with 2 different functions. There'd be 6 parameters. We don't know what will happen. Okay, we don't know what will happen. Okay, I'm going to be very just brief couple of minutes. Maybe I should say that, look, if you're just looking at the power deficit at large scales, the data there is very uncertain. The reported power deficit is not very significant, even if, you know, as we've done in our fits, you're not going to be able to draw convincing conclusions. No one's going to believe your theory about quantum relaxation just because you get a 2 sigma improvement fitting this low power deficit, which is kind of more, maybe it's just a fluctuation anyway. So the project here really is to, well, this is just stage 1. You know, there's going to be a stage 2 and 3 where we're going to add in more detailed predictions. And the hope is that, you know, a slight improvement from these different parts of the signatures that we're predicting may add up to something significant. So two things in particular we've been looking at are oscillations and statistical anisotropy. Let me just very quickly mention that, you know, the inverse tangent deficit, well, we ignored the oscillation. These oscillations are predicted by quantum relaxation. Okay, quantum relaxation has this prediction. The primordial power spectrum should have oscillations at large scales. Are there oscillations at large scales in the CMB data? Maybe, maybe. I'm looking at this with one of my students at Clemson, Aditya Kandhadai. Something else that's interesting is statistical anisotropy. I promise I'll be just 1 minute. I pointed out to you that if the ensemble of skies is statistically isotropic, it implies this diagonality condition. The Planck data, they've actually reported evidence for correlations here, for non-zero values here at low L. In fact, even at high L, but I won't go into that. Let's just think about low L. Now, something we also mentioned in some of the early papers, that look, if I have a mode, a given mode with a given wave vector, it starts out with a certain non-equilibrium distribution. It evolves, I get this inverse tangent power deficit. If I now look at a mode with the same wavelength, but a wave vector in a different direction, so it's a different mode, it's a different degree of freedom. The initial non-equilibrium distribution could be different. And when you evolve it, you expect to get an inverse tangent function, but with but where the coefficients here, let me just write it, well, okay, where the coefficients will be different. These coefficients, in other words, could depend on the direction of the wave vector. So this is something, so basically this squeezing factor C can depend on K. So I have a paper about this. I've studied a model where I've taken these parameters to depend weakly on the direction of the wave vector, and you can derive some interesting predictions. So for instance, these, if I look at LL plus one correlation, so where L primed is L plus one, you can derive a relationship, you know, how this scales with L and a number of other things. The hope here is that, look, if I combine the prediction for the power deficit with predictions for the oscillations and predictions for anisotropies, all of which are sort of quite weak, but maybe combining them together, possibly, if we're lucky, when you match with the data, maybe the significance will be something that's possibly convincing. And of course, the significance could be for or against. Okay, so we don't know. So my final slide. Something interesting is a quote from the Planck 2013 saying that the evidence for the large-scale anomalies is significant, and yet few physically compelling models have been proposed to account for them, and none so far that provide a common origin. When they say common origin, they're talking about the large-scale power deficit and the large-scale anisotropies. They occur in the same region. It would be nice if there was a model that predicts both. Since then, a number of people have actually produced models which try to explain both. Our model, you know, let's say we have a mechanism for a common origin, certainly, because quantum relaxation, I can start out with a non-equilibrium distribution whose width is smaller than quantum, so I can have a power deficit. I can have the distribution that varies with the direction of the wave vector, so it's anisotropic. When relaxation occurs at short wavelengths, you expect to relax to the quantum equilibrium. So you get the standard quantum results with the standard power spectrum and statistical isotropy. So you expect to have the standard result isotropy at small scales and low power and statistical anisotropy at large scales. So far, where we are with the data analysis, the model is consistent with the data. It does as well as, you know, the sort of standard models with just a power law, whatever. So, you know, there's no clear evidence, positive or negative yet. But as I said, so far, the only data fitting we've done is for the sort of simplest, you know, just the inverse tangent spectrum, ignoring the oscillations with no anisotropy. Not considering anisotropies or tensor perturbations. So we still have a long way to go. And there it is. So, you know, that's where we are with, we have a theory which reproduces quantum mechanics for a certain state of statistical equilibrium. In principle, it's a wider physics of non-equilibrium. The hypothesis is that this relaxation process took place in the very early universe. We've, in some simplified models, with some assumptions, we've derived signatures of this quantum relaxation that amount to a large-scale power deficit in the CMB and large-scale statistical anisotropies and also oscillations at large scales. The fits to the data so far, just for the power deficit, well, it's doing okay, but you know, nothing to write home about or you know, or impress my mother with or anything like that. But there it is, and I'll stop there. And thank you so much. Thank you.
As is traditional, first we have questions from the students. No questions from the students? Okay, that was a lot. Let me open it up then. Anybody questions? Ms. Daesh? You're almost a student.
I think one of the issues that seems to arise in this, at least the Breuer-Borman interpretation, is the basis in which you decide to basically apply this probability to, because, I mean, I could always, in quantum mechanics, I can change the basis. For example, I can go do a canonical transformation, basically can go from position and momentum to action angle variables, for example. And I think in quantum mechanics, it should be, as long as it's a canonical transformation, it should be invariant, the evolution. But it seems to me that it's not clear, even if it's well-defined, if I say go from position to action angle variables, there is such a thing. Yeah.
This theory is defined in the configuration basis.
Right.
It's saying that the actual structure of the world is you've got a configuration space wave function guiding actual configurations that are moving. Now, this is actually important. I think I mentioned this a bit before, but the when you discuss how this theory reproduces quantum mechanics, there's this crucial. Let me maybe back up a little bit and put it this way, that mathematically in quantum mechanics, you have these transformations, different bases. If you look at what you need in order to understand the outcomes of experiments, all you really need is the configuration basis. Because, you know, the outcome of an experiment is going to be, you know, it's registered, you've got some pointer position, you've got some particle that's detected here rather than there, you've got a spot on a screen. In other words, you can reduce the outcomes of measurements to measurements of positions. In fact, a similar thing comes up, you know, if you do the path integral formulation of quantum mechanics in configuration space. So Feynman and Hibbs in their book in the 60s, Path Integral Quantum Mechanics, they discuss this. They say, look, I can just talk about probabilities for positions. When you do, for example, a momentum measurement, you know, you can measure the momentum of a particle by a time of flight method. The particle escaped from a box. After a certain time, it lands here, you know, the distance traveled divided by the time, I can, you know, define a quantity that I call the measured momentum. You can discuss all of that just in terms of position measurement. So in other words, strictly speaking, even in standard quantum mechanics, I could just say, look, I don't really care about all these other bases. I can just work in the configuration space basis. The wave functional in that basis gives me a probability distribution for configurations. In other words, it's going to give me the probability distribution for particle positions, where they land, this pointer, you know, my apparatus pointer, where it points to. I can reduce everything to configurations. And it's something, a point that Bell also emphasized. So, you know, you don't really need the other bases.
But when it comes to field theory, for example, it's not clear what is the right configuration.
So in field theory, you know, for instance, here in the scalar field, we're just saying, look, there is a scalar field. If you're looking at, you know, electrodynamics, you have a vector potential, and there is also, I mean, there you would say that really the actual configuration is the vector potential modulo gauge transformation. So, you know, there's some that would be the actual beable, if you like. But certainly in field theory, you could say, well, what can happen is that you could have different formulations of a field theory that are equivalent in quantum mechanics and that here could be different. You'd have to make a choice as to, okay, this is, we're going to assume that this is the theory, this is the actual configuration evolving according to these laws of motion. But certainly this theory is tied to what, from a quantum point of view, is a configuration space basis.
Okay, next, there was a question up here.
Yeah, so you described that most particles we see today are in equilibrium in your sense because
yes.
they come from the Big Bang. But what would happen if you do the Schwinger effect and you create two new particles?
Right, good. Okay, good. So, so it's something I actually discussed in a paper with another student about 4 years ago, this kind of thing. So if you have, if you study that kind of thing, you've got... The initial state there, you would have the vacuum. Let's say it's the vacuum for the electron-positron field. You'd have the vacuum, and let's say you've got an external electric field that is creating particles. What you find in the quantum description of this, that the probability distribution of the particles that are created depends on the probability distribution for the initial vacuum fields, or the initial vacuum configuration. And so if the vacuum is initially in equilibrium, you expect to just get the usual results. If the vacuum was actually out of equilibrium, then the created particles could have a non-standard spectrum. Maybe I might just mention that something, one of the many things I would have liked to talk about but haven't, is there is an idea that we've discussed in some other papers, that in the very early universe, I've said that all the systems we have access to have this long and violent astrophysical history, but actually there might be some relic particles around, floating around, that decoupled at very early times, okay? And in fact, there are models, for instance, models of dark matter based on gravitinos. Gravitinos, a spectrum of decoupled very early. Possibly, if the particles decouple sufficiently early, they might not have had time to reach equilibrium. And they could still be floating around today and be out of equilibrium. But, this is sort of getting even more, well, not even more. Anyway, there's a possibility that there's some relic matter today that's out of equilibrium. And that's a subject that I've developed in some other papers. Again, of course, very much a long shot. But there you go. Let's say in principle that's possible. Not today. Want today? The vacuum here in the lab is in the vacuum fields or the configuration is all in equilibrium. You switch on an external electric field. What you create is all the Born rule is going to just propagate. So.
Okay, Neil.
Does your point of view, the Brayley-Brown theory, give you any different approaches for dealing with gravity? Because
right.
that's where you're really good.
Yes.
But you didn't talk about
right, that. No, I haven't spoken about that. Okay, all right. So I'm giving a talk on this tomorrow, but basically, when I was first working on this, my thought was that, look, this is a non-local theory. It, these models that I've been talking about, they assume you have a preferred foliation of space-time. It seemed to me natural to think that, look, this theory is, certainly in the non-gravitational context, there is a preferred time parameter, okay, there's a preferred foliation. So you would think that, look, when I go to gravity, well, there should be a preferred time. And I, instead of having a Wheeler-DeWitt equation, I should have a time-dependent Schrödinger equation. And we can do similar kind of thing, and we're going to have a good excuse for why there's a preferred time parameter because of the non-locality. So I've worked with that a bit on and off. I have some models. So for instance, with another student, I had an idea back in the 90s that York time, for various reasons, seemed to me a particularly nice possible preferred time parameter. I've worked on that recently again with a PhD student. That's one way to go. Okay, there's one way to go. But more recently, I've actually got interested in, the other way to go, which is something that was developed for many years, in particular by Nelson Pinto Neto in Rio, who's one of these, does a lot of work with bouncing cosmologies. He's done a lot of work with de Broglie-Bohm quantum cosmology, but assuming the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which I used to think surely this is not going to be consistent. You know, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you know, in the back, you know, the thought behind it is that there's no preferred time parameter. Here, the non-locality requires a preferred time parameter. I thought, surely this is not going to work. Nelson, with some collaborators, they seem to have shown that actually you get a consistent dynamics out of this. And I'll talk a bit about this tomorrow. The problem with it, there's still a problem with how you define a quantum equilibrium state. Okay, in quantum gravity, you know, I mean, the sort of quantum equilibrium I've been talking about, if I have a time-dependent Schrödinger equation, I can define the usual sort of conserved current, I have a conserved density given by psi squared, you know, I can show that there exists an equilibrium state. When you're in quantum gravity with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, well, there's all these problems about, you know, how to recover a time dependence, how to recover, you know, a standard quantum description. So lately, what I've been thinking is, this is the subject of the talk tomorrow, that perhaps in the quantum gravitational context, there is no state of equilibrium. That the Born rule is just simply just not there at all. It's not just that you can have deviations from the Born rule. It's not a conserved probability. There is no quantum equilibrium in quantum gravity. That's the idea for tomorrow. And the idea, what I'm going to be looking at tomorrow, is a model where you say, look, I have the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I have a guidance equation for the three metric. It defines the dynamics of individual metrics. But there is no conserved Born rule. And the idea is that it's only in some effective regime where you have an effective time-dependent Schrödinger equation emerging that you recover a quantum equilibrium state. And what I'll discuss tomorrow is the intermediate regime where I would have an effective time-dependent Schrödinger equation. For instance, I'm going to be looking at a matter field on a background space-time. You derive, following some work done by Klaus Kiefer, where you have an effective time-dependent Schrödinger equation for the matter field, but with corrections from quantum gravity. And I'm going to be discussing the idea that these corrections actually break the stability of the Born rule, that the psi-squared distribution is not preserved in time. So in other words, I think as someone asked, well, you know, can you create non-equilibrium from a prior equilibrium state? The idea here is that possibly quantum gravitational effects could do that. And if that was true, you would expect that in inflationary cosmology, if I have trans-Planckian modes, you know, emerging from the Planck radius, you would expect them to emerge and be out of equilibrium. So, you know, that's a whole other subject. So there you go. It's a long reply, but that's okay. Where that is.
We have time for one more question, if this last question. Anybody? No, well, great. Well, we have snacks and coffee and tea in the Eastern downstairs.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.